You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. You've heard people talk about unpacking something, right? Trying to understand it piece by piece. Morgan Jerkins is doing a lot of unpacking for someone who is only in her mid-20s. She's exploring what it means to idolize the white cheerleaders as a young black girl, how dating feels different as a black woman, why deciding to put a photograph of herself with long, beautiful braids on the cover of the book was not without risk. Jerkins' series of essays is collected in a new book titled This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black Female and Feminist in White America. And she's with us from New York City. Morgan, I'm so happy we could reschedule this. I know that we were going to do this about a month ago, and I'm glad you have time because it's good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
You know, this is a lot of self-examination for someone in her mid-20s. I don't know if I had the perspective on my life in my mid-20s to make such smart and pointed observations. Talk to me a bit about how you felt it was the moment to do some writing about this.
Well, I will say that I got into writing initially as a place to hide. I started writing when I was 14 years old, and I was being bullied every single day. And I used fiction as a way to create new worlds and new people as a therapeutic vent. And it wasn't until probably my last year of college that I started to become more politically conscious. And I wanted to write more nonfiction and as a way also to strengthen my voice and my place in the world. And about a year into freelancing, an agent found me and she asked me, would I be interested in doing an essay collection? And by that time, you know, you had Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist, Leslie Jamison's The Empathy Exam. So there was a lot of demand for essay collections by women. And you know, once I endeavored to write about black girlhood and womanhood in the form of a book proposal, which is what you have to do in order to send to editors who will consider acquiring the book, all of these memories just started to rise to the surface as if I was summoning them. I started to think about, you know, wanting to be a white cheerleader. I started to think about mental health in the black community. And it wasn't hard conjuring these memories and feelings, but it was hard to articulate them because a lot of these memories were traumatic and I buried them in order to get on with my life.
I interviewed Roxane Gay a week ago Saturday on stage, and we talked about her decision around what she will reveal, what she's going to keep private, and the expectation in the world about showing more if you're a woman, if you're an African-American woman, like what the market demands of that. Mm-hmm. She thinks it's different. I wonder if you do, too.
Well, I was going to say my experience has been a bit different. I have found when I was on my book tour back in February that a lot of people ask me if I have gone too far with revealing, whether or not I overshared at certain points. I'm actually writing an essay about this now, but I mean, if I can make an argument here, I honestly feel like that question is a bit misogynistic.
Tell me why.
I think because if you think about it, the idea of a confession has been traditionally male. If you think about, for example, St. Augustine's confession, he was talking about his lust and his promiscuity. There are many different examples of men writing about their past transgressions. And when a woman owns up to it and says, hey, this is what I thought, it was nasty, or this is what I did, it may not have been right, it may have been humiliating, but I'm owning up to it. What does it say what does it say for a reader to ask a woman who's owning up to an experience and giving that shame back to say, well, don't you think you went too far? Is it Who's allowed to set that boundary besides the writer herself?
I think yes, all of that. But I also think what Roxane was saying was, and she's, the show is on the podcast and you can find it online. So I don't want to paraphrase too much. I'm saying that to our listeners.
Sure.
But I think she also felt that ambivalence about, do I have to share this to get attention? Is it enough mm-hmm. to and to get rightful attention for mm-hmm. my ideas and my thoughts here? But mm-hmm, can I also withhold some of this stuff that I would just feel better withholding? You know, will the market, quote unquote, accept that? She spoke mm-hmm. with a lot of ambivalence about that.
You know, it's very interesting because back in 2014, when Bad Feminist was released, that's when I started my freelance career. And at that time, editors were hungry for essays by young women. And oftentimes, and even this is like an evergreen conversation, women were sort of afraid. A lot of women like myself, we've gotten our entry into the digital media world through disclosing our personal lives, but to what extent? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. What type of protection? And, you know, what's also interesting is I've had people ask me sort of that question of what to withhold and to share as if I shared it all and I didn't. there are many different topics that I did not share, mainly because I'm not ready. And also because I feel like that's something I'm still parsing through in my own personal time. But I think that is a very legitimate concern. How much do I have to give away, especially as a Black woman, because we're always expected to be so giving and so strong. And how can I give stuff away, especially because I write personally, but also what do I need to retain for my own sake?
You know, I really love the word undoing that you chose for the title, because I think there's many different ways to interpret it. So, you know, it could be an interpretation of you're letting down your guard. I mean, you're undoing your defenses in some ways. It could be that you're undoing and rethinking some closely held belief. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're even undoing your hair, which, as I noted in the introduction, is, you know, featured on the cover. We'll talk about the hair in just a minute, but
okay.
But why the undoing, and how, even since the collection has been published, maybe you've gotten new shades of interpretation of that. How does it hold now that the book is out in the world?
Yeah, well, I loved your interpretation of it. You know, that was the title that I chose when I was sending my book proposal out. And I was a bit nervous that it was too ominous. Mm. You know, if you say to someone, this will be your undoing, it's like, this will be your downfall. and for me, as I mentioned earlier, there were so many memories that I wanted to talk about as a way to connect with other people. But now I had the stability and the space and the time to go backwards and undo and unpack those memories and to scrutinize the world as well as myself. So when I think about this will be my undoing, it's like what you said. I'm taking apart these moments and I'm unpacking them and trying to undo. And also I have a fixation with words that start with the prefix un. So undoing, unwinding, unraveling. I love all of it, because what it does is it makes me think of nuance. It makes me think of how everything has a root. Nothing just happens randomly. And so I love the word.
I mean, the other thing that I thought is this idea that in the undoing, in the telling, right, in the letting down the defenses, maybe you would come to some new reflection, or you'd come to some new conclusion. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of that would come back to you as you went out there and talked about this. And so, mm-hmm. and I think this is a powerful thing for many of us who think we know what we think, to mm-hmm. undo mm-hmm. some of that, right? Isn't that the highest quality of intellectual reflection? I think I know this. I'm willing to be a little undone on that from high quality argument about it, right? I sense that you were open to that. Yeah.
I wholeheartedly agree. I think, you know, I love those moments when I'm talking to friends and something's bothering me. And as I'm speaking, there's like a record scratch. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. And then I'm arriving somewhere as I feel like exactly. I've already got it down what I thought that I knew about myself in this particular experience. And yet, and I hate to use this sort of synonym because I think it's ubiquitous in writing, but you know, think about a flower and the way that it blooms and there's many different petals there, many different layers. That's how I think about with my thought process, and I'm still learning and I'm still undoing things. But yeah, I mean, even, you know, when I decided I was going to write this book, I said I have to be both the subject and the narrator.
Yeah.
I have to put myself on the line and say, this is my experience. And oftentimes I have to be as claustrophobic as possible so you can understand my thoughts before I pull back and expand and show you how what I thought does not exist in a vacuum.
You know, I think starting off with that essay about wanting to be a cheerleader and what it meant to be a black girl wanting to join the white cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. I mean, you signal to us from the very beginning of this collection. I think there was thought put into making that the first essay too, about there will be some undoing here. There will be some what it means to be the subject and the narrator. Was it accidental that came first, or were you... You're telling us, hang on, buckle in, this is what this is.
Well, I wanted the cheerleader experience to be the first chapter. And, you know, the second half of that chapter is about my time in high school and dealing with anti-blackness and the way I projected it. And I wanted that to be in the middle of the book. But my editor, my acquiring editor, was like, no, these two essays need to be combined and it needs to be in the first chapter. And I was afraid. I was
really
afraid that, oh, absolutely, because I thought it was too hard. I said, you know, it's like I think about it as a roller coaster ride. There needs to be, you need to buckle in, as you say, and you need to go up the hill. And then there's that pause at the top before you descend. And I thought it was just too much movement in the first, if it were going to be the first chapter. But then, you know, because I was afraid that a black woman was going to go through Barnes and Noble and flip to that, to some section in the first chapter and be so turned off that she would just scoff and put it back where she found it.
But that hasn't happened.
No, I haven't heard of it happening. When I read the book in its entirety, I was like, it had to be together, because in order for me to show readers how triumphant I feel as a black woman now, I had to go back to the moments where I did not feel triumphant or good, period, about being a black girl. Mm-hmm. And I just want to preface and say, you know, not every black girl has my experience. Some black girls, they knew they were black. They loved being black, you know, from the moment they knew they were black. But that wasn't my story. And I had to own up to that.
Your story was admiring the white cheerleaders. I mean, you know, I find this, even though race ends up being so core to your own realization and the things you understand now as you look back, a lot of what you're experiencing is pretty universal too, right? Mm-hmm. Why do we admire and idolize the people we idolize as girls who are, you know, who are going through these passages right at this time of our lives?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting, and I really wish I had someone who does sports and someone who does sociology to understand where did the first pop culture moment of cheerleader idolization begin? Where did it start?
Yeah.
Because I think about it, you know, I love movies. I think many of us do. But if you think about high school, the popular girl is almost always a cheerleader.
That's
and
right.
She's usually white. So I think there is, I do admit that perhaps there is universality in, you know, us wanting to be popular. That's universal. A lot of girls wanting to be cheerleaders. That usually cuts across racial lines. But I think for me, what distinguished that was also the fact that the whole cheerleading squad was white. And every time I would watch a movie, with the exception of maybe one black girl thrown into the cheerleading squad, and she wasn't the center of the story, the girl who was most sought after was a white cheerleader. And I thought about whiteness. I thought about beauty. I thought about popularity. I thought about cheerleading. And they all combined together into this dangerous blend because I was obsessed with it. And it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to.
It reminded me, as I was reading the essay, it reminded me of that famous study. And I know you know it. Kenneth and I looked this up after reading the essay. Kenneth and Marnie Clark, they gave black children a black doll and a white doll, and they watched many of the black children prefer the white doll. And they were really investigating how closely self-esteem and race are tied together. Here's the kicker. These kids were as young as 3 years old. Patterns get set so young.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's like, I want people to understand that, yes, my story is specific. You know, it's my truth. But this is not some phenomenon. You have black girls who are as young as 3 years old. You know what I'm saying? They may not be able to spell their whole name. And they are conditioned to idolize whiteness before they even know themselves. And I think about, you know, there's a section in my book where I talk about I was 3 years old when I got my first perm. And people who are not black will be shocked. They'll be like devastated. How can this happen? It's not a phenomenon. That's the culture that I grew up in. I guess it's a learning experience, but it's like, I'm not special in that regard.
So you've brought up the hair situation again. Did you say your first perm at three? I didn't remember
My first perm was at 3 years old.
Oh my gosh.
That was actually one of the earliest memories that I have of myself.
Whoa. And the smell of the chemicals, right? And the burn.
I didn't know
scalp.
What was happening. Like, I mean, one of the reasons why I stopped getting perms, let's say 10, 11 years ago, was because I could not deal with the pain. Like, it literally feels like your skull is on fire. Like, I remember my eyes being bloodshot red by the time that I would get to the sink. And the hairdresser would, you know, put her fingers through my scalp, and I could feel the scabs.
No.
Form.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah.
And so finally, 10 years ago, you said enough.
Yeah. I mean, I stopped getting perms cold turkey, which is something you should not do, when I was about 15 years old.
Why shouldn't you do that?
You shouldn't, because perms are like medicine in a sense, like medication. You can't just stop cold turkey. You have to wean yourself off of it. So when you stop cold turkey with a perm, your hair usually breaks off.
So what
I did was I started to just wear weaves and wigs and braids for my hair to grow back. But it wasn't until probably my second year of college where I actually took care of the hair that grew out of my scalp. That was curly and whatnot. Other than that, that time between when I was 15 to the time that I was 20, my hair was hidden. I had no idea how to take care of my hair. I just wanted it to be, underneath extensions for as long as possible. And that's not to say that wearing extensions are bad. I mean, I have extensions in my hair now, but the difference is my thoughts towards my own hair at the time were rooted in very low self-esteem.
We should talk about stereotypes in black women's hair, because you thought a lot about what you were going to write about this and how black women's hair is seen from the outside looking in, but also among women of color, how you talk about it. You thought a lot about how you're going to wear your hair on the cover. This is a conversation I don't think I've ever had with another writer. Why did you need to give so much thought to this?
Because it was going to be everywhere. It wasn't a situation where you see my avatar on Twitter or a small pixel of my face next to my byline. If I get that, it was going to be on the cover. And I realized how big of a deal this was. Initially, I didn't even think they were going to let me be on the cover. My parents were the ones that were like, you should just ask. And when I asked my editor 30 minutes later, she was like, go for it. And I was nervous because I said, should I wear my hair in braids? Mind you, the braids that I have on the cover, I had those braids in for about a month and a half, so they weren't exactly new. So I didn't know whether or not to wear braids, to wear my hair straight and flat iron, to wear curly with an afro. It's so many politics.
Why? Tell me why it matters that it would be flat ironed or braids or natural or what?
Well,
or how long it was or why?
Well, okay. So if I wore my hair straight, was I trying to be too businesslike? Were people going to assume things about my relationship to my hair, my racial identity? A lot of times, because my hair is straight, if my hair was a curly afro, what type of statement would that be? Would that be too radical? Would people think I'm trying too hard if they go on my Twitter and they see my hair in braids? And if I wear my hair in braids, well, my hair wasn't exactly new. So I was like, do people just think I didn't care? Like, for the black woman who can see the new growth around my edges, like what they say, well, did she just throw this cover together? Did she not get made? You know what I mean? It's just, it's
wow.
So many different thoughts. And I spoke to my editor and she just said, go exactly as you are. And that was it.
So knowing that the politics were complicated here, you chose that. I mean, and this is, it's the, I will tell you something, Morgan, your book landed on a book table that has a ton of different books and I have a lot of options. And it's because of that cover photo, I was drawn immediately to it.
Oh yeah. Oh,
you know, man, that, right?
The reception that I got from being on the cover of my own book was, for me, I'd never seen anything like it. I revealed it on Twitter, had the pre-order link, and immediately I was getting messages from friends, black friends, who were like, you don't know what this is going to mean for other black women, writers and non-writers, to know that they can be on the cover of their own book. And for me, I mean, it's hard because I don't want to sound narcissistic or vain, but that is one of my achievements too. The fact that my parents pushed me to ask, that fact that I did ask, and that I found an incredible publisher, an imprint that allowed for this to happen because they knew the statement that it was going to make. And I think also, you know, before you even open the book, you realize how intimate of a collection
that's
it's going
right.
to be.
That's right.
I cannot hide whatsoever. You see my face and now you're going to see my words.
That's why this is not in any way narcissistic or vain. I mean, this was a statement about your writing. It wasn't, look at me and how beautiful my makeup look. Nothing like that. And I knew that immediately.
I still can't believe I'm on the cover of my own book, to be honest with you. There's this weird depersonalization things that happen sometimes when big things occur for me, where it's like, oh yeah, that is me. that is. I still remember the day that I took it. For me, as long as I intend to write for many years, many decades. And I mean, when I think about being the age that I am, getting the opportunity that I have and to be on the cover of my own book, I don't take any of it for granted.
I can tell. Morgan Jerkins is with us. We're talking about her collection of essays in a book that's called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. We're talking about a lot of the ideas, the experiences that she's had that she develops in this collection of essays. You're welcome to join the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Callie says, Morgan, on Twitter, your guest is right that the critique of her choice of Revelations is misogynistic. Most critiques of women are. Men get critiqued on what they do. Women get critiqued on everything they do, say, and are. All the more so for women of color, in my observation. What do you make of that?
I agree. I wanted to snap, but you can't see my fingers. I agree. I just feel like, and I know it's coming from a well-intentioned place. People are concerned about whether or not I disclose too much. My mother, when I would write certain things online, she's like, oh my gosh, you know. But I think also there's something to be said about the way shame and humiliation is gendered. And I tell people all the time, you know, a lot of things that I write about in the book, I was ashamed about, but I have to give that shame back and own it because that made me who I am. Mistakes, misguided thoughts, all of that.
Can I guess that your mother squirmed a little about the sexuality part of this, which I think is super powerful in these essays?
She may have, but she never gave me any details.
She never mentioned that. Okay.
She read it, the whole book, 3 days before my book was released.
Wow.
And she messaged me at midnight. And mind you, she's going to hate that I disclose this. My mom usually goes to sleep around 9:30. So the fact that she was messaging me at midnight, I was like, oh, this must be serious. And, you know, what she said to me was, I wish I had that much courage at your age. And I'm just finding it now in my 50s.
Wow.
And that gave me the extra gust of wind to go forth and do what I was doing.
Call here from James in St. Paul. Hey, James. Hi. Glad you heard the discussion.
Hi. Yeah, I just kind of thought I might share kind of an odd bit of racial politics. My family is Caucasian, and in the 70s, my mother was an Avon lady. And at that time, Avon was the only major cosmetic company that had hair care, skin care, makeup products that fit women of color, skin tone, and skin and hair needs.
Huh.
And partly as a statement of politics and partly to just tap to a market where she could make a lot of money, she took my brother and I, and we would do the route in, at that time, what was a fairly segregated area of town. And the first couple of times, it was really kind of nerve-wracking because we were white people who really didn't belong in that neighborhood. But fairly quickly, the word got around between the women in the neighborhood that this particular woman and her kids were not to be bothered.
Hmm.
So from then on, we could really go places that other Caucasian people, it was dangerous for them to go to or uncomfortable to them. And we kind of got to know people in a way that we wouldn't have got to know.
From
those beauty products.
James, if I might, I think it's really interesting that Avon at that time was the only cosmetic company providing makeup for women of color. And Morgan, I just did a segment on this a couple of months ago that I don't know, there's more, but it really has not changed as significantly or as quickly as it should. I think we were talking about the new line that Rihanna had come out with.
Oh, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was about to say, I mean, when Rihanna came out with Fenty Beauty, that was a cultural milestone.
Was it?
Yes, especially for Black women, because I mean, you've seen what I look like. I don't have much trouble finding my shade of foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But for those Black women who are darker skin, when they found other makeup lines that had, you know, foundation that didn't exactly match, I found such glowing reviews. I would sometimes watch the makeup tutorials or makeup reviews on YouTube, and to see Black women's faces of like how relieved they were to find their color, it was very inspiring.
What is puzzling to me about that is it's such a, from a pure business opportunity, what was going on inside these big cosmetic firms that they didn't understand that there was a whole market they were missing?
Right, but I mean, if you think about it, it's not just makeup. Fashion's the same way. I mean, Black people spend a lot on clothes, there's still diversity problems in fashion. You can just ask Naomi Campbell. You think about books. Black women, I think, are one of, if not the biggest consumer of books, and yet we're still having these evergreen conversations about diversity in publishing. 90% of over 90% of publishing is still white.
Yeah.
So it's like there's always, well, why there's a big opportunity here? Why are people not feeding it? And it's because of systemic racism, systemic discrimination, that there are thankfully people in these respective industries who are trying to do so much to dismantle it.
I want to ask you about something you said in an essay about colorism within the community of color. You write, only Black women know Black girlhood well enough to understand that once a Black baby girl exits the womb, it's not enough that she's alive and well. What does that mean?
Oh my gosh. Sometimes, you know, growing up and you'd have pregnant Black women around, which, by the way, I mean, if you've been reading the New York Times, for example, or Serena Williams' story about her the birth of her daughter in Vogue, being a Black woman and who's pregnant is treacherous business. A lot of the mortality rates for Black women are very, very high. But even aside from that, you know, the idea of beauty is the little Black girl going to be dark skin or light skin? Is she going to have curly hair? Is she going to have nappy hair? Before the baby is even ushered into this world, these are the conversations that are not uncommon to find.
Because even within communities of color, we're applying some of the understanding of beauty that you were encountering when you wanted to be a cheerleader on an all-white cheerleading squad. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is people ask these questions not just because they're nosy, because they understand that the world is not kind to Black girls, and specifically girls who have a specific Black girls who have a specific type of hair texture, who have a specific skin color. So a lot of these questions that people ask is not just because they want to know, it's because they're trying to gauge how cruel the world is going to be to this Black girl, this unborn Black girl, depending on how she looks.
You know, I was reading this interview recently by SZA about her album Control, and she was saying that as a Black woman, she thinks about the caricatures that get applied to what she calls over-bold Black women. And how she's been shamed for much of her career and much of her youth because she happens to be a loud and confident Black woman. I think Michelle Obama got into this too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you own who you are and you walk through this world unabashedly, for Black women, that's difficult because people want to tear you down, whether they know you're doing it or not. And for someone like SZA, who creates songs talking about, you know, being lovelorn and being in these unconventional relationships or situationships, depending on the interpretation, for a lot of people, that makes them uncomfortable. But for me, I loved her album. I thought her album was one of the best albums of 2017. And I think that because she was so open with who she was on an emotional level. And I think, you know, that's something that I also wanted to tie into with my book, is that I wanted people to experience the gamut of emotions that I felt, that I'm not always strong. I may not be always confident. Sometimes I'm weak and sometimes I'm low, but each feeling has its own value and place within my life.
Sounds like a good moment to close with SZA's 20-something. What do you say, Morgan? Is that cool?
Okay.
Good to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Morgan Jerkin's book is called This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America.
Honesty hurts when you're getting older. I gotta say I miss the way you need me. Why you ain't say you was getting bored? Why you ain't say I was falling short? How you leave me out?
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.